Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
How's it going?
Outstanding. How are you?
Great.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I don't usually get in black jeeps with men I just met, but...
Hey, I'm not gay, but 10 bucks is 10 bucks, right?
Looks like we're off to a good start already.
So, you want to see my reservation?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Earlier this year, I drove up to upstate New York to meet a man we're calling Danny. He's a retired New York State police officer who agreed to show me around the Aguasasne Mohawk territory. He asked to be anonymous because he still investigates and testifies on cases in the area.
Should we get rolling?
Absolutely. Yeah. Sounds good.
Danny's a longtime trooper who spent 12 years working in this part of New York, just by the Canadian border. And back in the day, a big part of Danny's job was patrolling the Aguasasne territory. They called it res duty.
What was the reaction of most rookie cops that had their first year on res duty?
Deer in the headlights. When we would first take them down there, they couldn't believe. They go, "Well, can they do that?" and we'd go, yeah, it's the res."
For most cops, res duty felt like frat house hazing, but Danny loved it.
Early '80s to late '80s, it was the Wild West. It was nothing back then to have 25, 30. Yes, 25, 30 pursuits in a night. And you're doing 100, 110, and the car you're pursuing is throwing beer bottles at you. And it wasn't their first rodeo. They don't throw them straight back. No. They throw them up in the air, so they land in front of you. But lost a few windshields, but it was just a crazy time. Someone nicknamed them Res Rockets because their cars would fucking fly.
Aside from car chases and beer bottles, this was a turbulent time in Aguasasne. Angry residents who believed that the native police were siding with the federal government demanded that the police disband and leave the reservation. And in the years that followed, that security void was filled by folks who had money, and more importantly, had weapons.
What would this entrance have looked like 30 years ago?
Blocked with tires stacked 5 or 6 deep, 10 high. At night, they'd have bonfires, and they're all standing around it. The natives with their faces covered with masks, carrying assault weapons, shotguns. and they had actual shifts that people were assigned to roadblocks, and they had roving patrols.
Danny isn't native, and he's a law enforcement officer, so he doesn't really provide the definitive perspective of Aguasasne. But the picture he paints of the place is compelling nonetheless, and shows just how tense things were back then. He was forced to work undercover because of the hostility that state police faced.
I mean, we didn't have, you know, the fancy lighting these spoiled punks have today. You had fucking burn barrels. And it was medieval. And here you go up to the burn barrels, and you got guys standing there with cowboy hats and shotguns and smoking big cigars. And
did you feel like you were in a movie back then?
It could have been. It abso-fucking-lutely could have been.
If that movie ever got made, there's no doubt what the opening shots would be. A gigantic warehouse-looking building on the corner of a main road here in Aguasasne. Today, it's totally abandoned and boarded up. But 30 years ago, this was a casino. And in the summer of 1989, it was the scene of one of the most dramatic events of Aguasasne's history. The casino was full of gamblers and security guards. The parking lot was full of protesters who wanted to shut it all down. And a cavalry of police cars were on their way. It was a classic Mexican standoff.
And when we got to the casino, there was probably maybe 8-10 troop cars, probably 20-30 troopers, officers, investigators. We were met with two Ma-Deuce 50 caliber machine guns on the roof of that casino.
From Campside Media and Dan Patrick Productions, this is Running Smoke.
And we're getting ready to go! Buggity, buggity, buggity! Let's go racing, boys!
I'm Rajiv Gola, and this is Episode 7, Civil War. When Derek turned himself into the police, he knew then and there that he was going to fight this case all the way to the end. Whether it was bankruptcy, jail time, or victory, Derek was all in. And now he was appealing his case on a constitutional basis. This was the first time a tobacco case had come this far. In every other instance, the case would languish in appeals for years before being dismissed by a judge. It seemed like Canada wasn't interested in addressing the issue head on. But this time was different. The judge had agreed to hear the case, and the stage was set for a landmark decision. But it's exactly because the stakes were so high that the Mohawk Nation had asked Derek and Hunter to drop their case. The risk of losing was too great, and they'd already seen what could happen when things went wrong.
They were concerned that we're using these agreements that were made as a defense, which is true.
Hunter Montour, Derek's co-accused.
And they were worried that if we lose, that it's going to affect the Mohawk Nation. I said, well, what the hell's the point of having these tools if we can't use them? When are you going to use them? Well, there's another time for this. When? This is the time. Right now is the time. So don't be dumbass. Oh, well, we know we shouldn't do this right now. You should just roll over and take it. Not me. I have every right to use these laws or whatever you want to, however you want to phrase it, agreements that were made that are binding. So why can I use this to defend myself? If I can't use it, what the hell good is it? And when are you going to use it? I don't see any of you fighting for land or pushing for more rights. I don't see it. I've dedicated myself to whatever I could to help our nation, and I should be able to use my what I'm fighting for to help myself to get out of whatever this stupid ass predicament I'm in. That's what we do this for.
The MNCC is basically stating that I'm using my rights because of a criminal activity, which is not criminal activity. In the eyes of the government, it's criminal activity, but for us here, it's just our, it's what we've grown up to do. I mean, there's not much left. I mean, they stole all our land. they have highways coming through our reserve at all ends. I mean, we have to benefit from it somehow. I mean, we have the gas stations and we have cigarettes. So that's what they get for stealing our land.
The question at the heart of Derek's case boiled down to this. Do rights belong to an individual or do they belong to a community? Derek argued that the rights belong to individuals. Mohawks had a right to trade tax-free, and he had just as much claim to that right as any other Mohawk. But the Council of Chiefs, well, they believed that right belonged to the community and community institutions. The way they saw it, Derek had done his business without the permission of the Mohawk government. So it wasn't appropriate for him to claim Mohawk rights now that he was in trouble. It's a debate over what sovereignty actually means. And it's one that nearly tore apart one Mohawk territory decades ago. To understand why it's such a difficult question, we have to go back to the 1970s, to the birth of the modern Native rights movement. We'll get into all that right after the break.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This was the era when groups like AIM, the American Indian Movement, put Native rights on the map and staged radical protests, like reclaiming Wounded Knee from corrupt leaders.
Either we force the federal government to kill us all, or else they come out and they negotiate and meet our demands.
They occupied Alcatraz and demanded its return to Native people.
The early morning peacefulness of Fisherman's Wharf was shattered suddenly by the rhythmic beat of Indian tom-toms.
And they even took over the Bureau of Indian Affairs in D.C. after a cross-country march they called the Trail of Broken Treaties.
The Indians came from everywhere, and they came with a purpose.
About time we started doing something.
I think this is a test to see how the government can uphold the law.
Native Americans were developing a radical political consciousness, and sovereignty became the political project of the moment. Sovereignty meant writing your own rules, standing on your own 2 feet, and not letting anyone else tell you otherwise. An important part of that fight for self-determination was economic. But not everyone agreed on exactly how to build up that economy. It became an especially contentious issue once some Native communities started experimenting with gambling and tax-free tobacco. It was a sort of legal gray area that would soon become a battleground. Doug George Canendio is a prominent Mohawk journalist and advocate who lives outside of Aguasasne. Back in the day, he reported on how these new ideas were changing his community.
I was involved with this issue when it first came to our attention in 1984, when individuals from our sister community of Ganawage approached us and asked if they could secure a license to transport tobacco products across an international border. And they wanted, you know, to do this in order to form a new economy, to introduce wealth into our communities.
Tobacco was risk-free, had high profit margins, and a constant demand. It seemed like a golden ticket. But Doug George and the traditional leadership council he sat on weren't fully convinced.
That council was concerned that tobacco, something that's extremely sacred to the Mohawk people, should become a commodity. And they knew that there would be serious ramifications. You know, our elders told us, they warned us, don't do this. And we thought we could control it. We were wrong.
Pretty quickly, the tobacco industry swept through the Mohawk territories before the Nation Council could make a decision. The handful of the Native entrepreneurs who got into the cigarette game early on became massively wealthy in a short amount of time. And Doug George was afraid of the implications of that sort of wealth gap.
Unless we had firm control of this, these individuals were going to grow very powerful. They were going to do something that was fairly alien to our Mohawk way of life, in that they were going to create a handful of very rich people who were then going to turn around and use their wealth to manipulate the community towards their own ends. Ours is not a community that is given to capitalism. You know, we were a people who developed a system by which all of us could prosper. And we were adamantly opposed to the rise of a wealthy elite who would then dictate how that society would be to the rest of us. That's something that is so alien to Mohawk tradition.
Tobacco money started pouring into other lucrative gray markets, like casinos and bingo halls. Even though gambling was illegal elsewhere in Canada and the U.S., the smugglers and casino owners claimed that the reserves were sovereign territory. Federal laws didn't apply. Tobacco and gambling were controversial issues within the territory, but they were symbols for an even bigger set of questions.
These people are using that and saying, I am sovereign, therefore I got a right to do whatever I want on my sovereign territory. Well, it's not your territory. You aren't sovereign. You're not. Sovereignty belongs to the collective. And we fought great battles as Mohawks and as Natives in order to secure a certain level of self-control and self-determination. But these guys were undermining that. They espoused all of this rhetoric about helping the nation and the people and, you know, upholding traditional values, but they were destroying the very thing that they were claiming to try to strengthen. You know, they were destroying the idea of a stable central government. They were undermining the authority of traditional law. They were violating our customs and our culture.
This was the battleground on which the Mohawk Civil War would play out. Anti-tobacco and anti-gambling advocates on one side, trying to preserve their traditions against an influx of money earned off of vice and exploitation. These were known as the antis. On the other side were the casino and tobacco supporters, tired of playing by the old rules. Gambling and cigarettes offered a way out, offered a way to build an economy. Why should they sit out while everyone else moves ahead?
How did the antis see rights differently than you see rights?
They don't mind being in the armpit of the United States government.
Loran Thompson was a traditional leader in Agwesasne back in the 1980s. He had a reputation as a fierce and wily defender who would take radical action to protect the community. Once, when loggers tried to cut down trees to establish a border around Agwesasne, Loran confiscated their machinery and kicked off a months-long standoff with government officials. Loran believed that tobacco and gambling offered massive potential for Mohawks to lift themselves up. Sure, it wasn't exactly clean or noble money, but he felt that was a reasonable cost to achieve true economic independence. He clashed with others in the community and ultimately lost his leadership position for trying to bring a casino to the reserve. He felt that the antis were holding the community back.
They don't mind their treaties being secondary to the United States law and court decisions. They don't mind that. In other words, they accept being American citizens, okay? Whereas the hardcore traditional people will stand up and fight for their rights in their own land, just as the settlers will stand up, grab a gun, and fight for their freedom. See, that's how we fight. We stand as equals to the government of the United States, the people of the United States, but it created a problem because there was so much money being made that a lot of the community wanted a part of it. Because they were starting to say, you're using my rights to do this, right? So there was all kinds of conversations going on at that time, and that what created a difference of opinion all over the place. And from there, it just kept growing. And then all of a sudden, there was protests from the Longhouse people. People we thought we were on, that were on our side. So they did the protests, and then it came to the point where they shut off they closed off the toll gate where the buses were coming through. So that put a halt to the major part of the casino.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta. visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Run and Smoke from Campside Media.
By the late 1980s, tensions between the antis and the tobacco gambling crowd were growing intense. Cigarettes were coming in by the semi-truckload, and streets were backed up with tour buses full of Americans and Canadians coming in to gamble at the casinos. Money was flowing into the reserve like never before. Buildings were going up, roads were being paved, and smoke shacks were popping up like mushrooms after a rain. And just as Doug George had predicted, a new class of wealthy elites was turning the old way of life in Aguasasne upside down. The casinos had become incredibly contentious on the reservation, and Tony's Vegas International was at the center of the debate. There was a federal ban on gambling, but the owner of the casino, Tony Laughing, said that didn't apply in Aguasasne. It was his right as a Mohawk citizen. State police begged to differ.
What ignited really the issue in 90 was Tony was running an illegal casino out of there. At the time in New York State, it was illegal to run an illegal casino. Go figure. So we had undercover officers go into the casino, and he had, I don't know, 100, 125 slot machines. Well, that was illegal. So state police put a detail together to raid the casino. And somehow the natives were apprised of the oncoming raid.
Armed Mohawks and casino security were standing by, ready to defend the casino.
We were met with two Ma Deuce 50 caliber machine guns on the roof of that casino. That's an impressive sight when you're sitting there with a 357 Magnum and a 12-gauge shotgun. So, discretion being the better part of valor, we left. And as soon as we left, that's when the roadblocks went up and the fun really started.
Once the police left the scene, anti-gambling protesters realized that they were on their own. And in the spring of 1990, they decided to fight this battle themselves.
A group of people said enough, and they decided that they were going to stop a lot of these large buses that were coming onto reservation every day and to patronize the casinos. And so they formed a roadblock. And they said, holy cow, that they had actually done this. And the people at the roadblocks were well aware that they did this at high risk.
That risk came from the fact that, at the time, there were no state or Mohawk cops operating on the reserve. They'd been kicked out years earlier in a different set of protests. The only policing force in Aguasasne now was the Mohawk Sovereignty Security Force, otherwise known as the Mohawk Warriors. The Warrior Society had been around for decades, and in the early days, it was simply a revival of older customs. It was a society for young men who wanted to fulfill traditional roles. Their symbol was the flag of a Mohawk warrior head on a red background. It was the same flag that Derek had painted on the hood of his race car.
Warrior Handbook was really about the role of the men. And it channeled that energy, and it put it, to me, in a good way. That it gave the men direction and what to do.
Kenneth Deere was a spokesperson for the Mohawk Nation during these years, and he saw how the warriors in Aguasasne were getting drawn into a political battle.
It wasn't a criminal organization. It wasn't supposed to be a criminal organization, you know. It was supposed to be a way to teach the men their responsibilities within tradition, you know. And unfortunately, some people used it like a gang. And I can't support that.
When anti-gambling protesters set up roadblocks in the spring of 1990, they knew that they'd be up against the Mohawk Warriors.
And there was going to be a reaction, and the Mohawk Sovereignty Security Force, which was supposed to provide a protection for the community, showed where their real allegiance lied, in that they became deeply involved with the casino group and trying to break the roadblocks in order to resume the smuggling and resume the casino gambling. And these guys were lazy. They weren't trained. They didn't have the discipline. They didn't have the psychological background, the spiritual background. They didn't know how to control their weapons. They would ride around in these souped-up cars and trucks and RVs, not RVs, but SUVs, and with these weapons whose only purpose was to kill other human beings. And they were fueled by alcohol and drugs. And they were employed as goon squads by the cigarette smugglers who had now become the casino owners. They had nothing of the virtues of a real Mohawk, if you want to call it, warrior.
The roadblocks were an escalation in the war between antis and casino owners. Each side was dug in, accusing the other of collaborating with the federal government, of corrupting the community. Mohawk warriors would drive around the reservation in pickup trucks with automatic weapons and military fatigues. They manned checkpoints at the border of the reserve and became a vigilante force. They had become a flashpoint in this conflict. Their supporters saw them as defenders of the community, but to the antis, they were a marauding gang serving the smugglers. Tensions rose every day, and violence was becoming a regular part of life in Agwesasne. Arson, vandalism, beatings and shootings, even a grenade attack.
It was, automatic gunfire, all sorts of things going on there that people across the river in Ontario would come out on their porch and listen to and say, "What in the world is going on over there?" But it was a combat situation.
Eventually, two people were killed in the crossfire. Other Mohawk nations, which had done their best to stay out of Agwesasne, now had little option but to intervene. Kenneth Deer, a traditional leader in Ganawage, was sent to Agwesasne to see what could be done about bringing both sides back together.
You know, we tried our best to stay out of the casino war over there. We were trying to be pulled into that. And our guys went there and looked at what's going on, and they came back and said, "Stay out of there." He says, there's no middle ground over there. Either you're for or you're against. The situation in Ogden was so bad that if you weren't for them, you were against them. If you want to build an economy, that's fine, and it should also be a collective, but when the collective didn't agree with what was going on, then it became an individual issue. It's hard to make peace when there's no middle ground. Yeah. And that's why, it ended up with two people being dead. Yeah. It was unfortunate. Yeah.
But then came the Oka crisis.
You can hear firing. I'm not sure if it's weapons or if it's... Yes, it is. They're firing at us.
Good evening. It was a bloody day at the Mohawk Indian community in Oka, Quebec, near Montreal. Provincial police in riot gear stormed the barricades the Mohawks had set up.
Here, there's semi-automatic weapon fire.
Now, is this police firing or Mohawk firing?
It appears to be coming from the police lines here.
A Quebec Police Force SWAT team moved in at dawn, and if ever a police operation was to go tragically wrong, it was this one.
What kind of people are you? There's children here, and you're shooting tear gas at us. We're unarmed, and you're aiming your weapons at us. What kind of people are you?
Police used gas, then bullets, but they weren't prepared for what met them. Dozens of heavily armed Mohawk men determined to hold what they say is their sacred ground.
There were clouds of tear gas, a hail of bullets, and in the midst of the battle, a policeman was killed. All this because of a dispute over a piece of forest the Indians claim is theirs, a forest town council wants to bulldoze to expand the local golf course.
Back in 1990, the mayor of a small village near Montreal, called Oka, was pushing a plan to develop a condominium complex and expand a golf course on the outskirts of town. But that land belonged to the Ganasetage Mohawk territory and served as a cemetery for the community. The protests that followed made international headlines and turned into a three-month-long standoff between armed Mohawk warriors and the Canadian military.
This golf course, that's what's killing our people. These people here who don't give a shit about anybody's rights. No Indian has a right on this land. Well, that's got to change.
It's Mohawk land. It's our land.
A
After the police retreated, the warriors celebrated, but it didn't last long.
Tonight, the barricade is completely surrounded by the Canadian Army. The soldiers have dug themselves in after a day of high tension and drama.
The images from the front lines were iconic. Overturned cars, barricades made out of burning tires and trees, men dressed in camouflage fatigues, with bandanas over their faces and AK-47s on their backs, all standing against Canadian soldiers in tanks and Humvees.
Again today, Native leaders in Ottawa demanded the federal government do something about the confrontation in Oka. But the government didn't respond.
Warriors were nearing hysteria at the sight of soldiers near their tribal cemetery.
The Indians at Oka have said they won't abandon their barricades until they get what they want.
After such a sudden, violent beginning, this could turn out to be a long standoff.
And there's also trouble on the Kanawage Reserve, south of Montreal, a sympathy blockade.
Indigenous territories across the continent took part in the protests. Leaders in Kanawage made the decision to shut down the Mercier Bridge, one of the major highways that links Montreal with towns across the St. Lawrence River. In the end, the protests were successful, and the golf course was never expanded.
Everything calmed down after 90, because that was one. You know, it went into the court system and all of that stuff, but it was one. Our people were known all over the place for defending and so on and so forth. Maybe we didn't win in court, or maybe some people lost in court, but overall, we won. We won there.
And then gambling and cigarettes just...
It didn't seem like the biggest issue anymore.
The victory at Oka was hard won, and months of protest had changed the perspective of many people in Mohawk territories.
1990... Of course, it was a big traumatic issue, but also it was an enlightenment to a lot of people. They realized those people, a lot of people who were against cigarettes, all of a sudden were surrounded by the SQ and the army. And there's more important things than cigarettes. And so when the crisis was over, I thought cigarettes would be dead. And it struggled for a little while, but then it just boomed. And you saw a whole lot of people who were against cigarettes who were now right in there, because they felt that, why be against cigarettes? They felt that it didn't matter anymore. Yeah, if the government wants to treat us that way, then I have no problem with getting involved in cigarettes. It's a change. The attitude towards cigarettes was like night and day. From 1989 to 1991 was like night and day.
Agwesasne's internal conflict had cooled down completely, but it left the debate over individual and collective rights unresolved. Danny, the cop we met at the top of the episode, saw the entire evolution of the conflict and how radically the smoke shops and casinos changed Agwesasne over the following decades.
I think the biggest lesson in my mind that the people down here learned from 90 was blockade cuts their own throat as well. Nothing was moving. You couldn't smuggle anything out because the state police had patrols at every exit. It was kind of like a stare down with the Mohawks. And so the smuggling went downhill. There was no civilian traffic. And back then, they depended tremendously on sales from non-natives for cigarettes, tobacco, gasoline. And that was just like somebody threw a switch. And so economically, it was a disaster for the people down here. I think that comes into play at why it's been so calm for so many years.
So interesting to hear you say that those things, like the casinos, the gas station, and tobacco is what improved life. Because in a lot of the books that get written about the Mohawk Civil War and stuff, it's always the cops and the antis standing together against the warriors. And the antis didn't like any of what they were seeing with these new businesses. Right, so I guess I just didn't expect law enforcement to take the side that cigarettes, gambling, gas stations were actually helping the community.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if it's fair to classify it as taking sides, but possibly just being realistic. I don't think the gambling has been detrimental to the reservation in the way the antis thought it was going to be. I know they pictured, you know, crack on the corner, hookers every 5 feet, Tony Soprano sitting in the lobby. But I don't think that has come to fruition at all. And since the gas stations came in, then the tobacco, and then the casino, the quality of life really has improved tremendously down there on the reserve. I mean, it provides opportunity. I mean, it's not all bad. It's not all bad.
Which brings us back to the present day and to the case that Derek is fighting against the Canadian government. Well, to be more precise, the conflict between Derek and the Mohawk Nation Council of Chiefs, which is trying to get him to drop his case. Derek is claiming that as a Mohawk, he has the right to conduct his business tax-free. But the Council of Chiefs is claiming that Derek was not acting with the permission or authority of the Mohawk Nation. So therefore, he can't claim native rights. It's the same question that was at the heart of the Agwesasne conflict. Do rights belong to the individual, or do they belong to the community? Kenneth Deere believes that those rights are vested in the community, and that Derek's case could do more harm than good.
What is the risk of presenting a case of collective rights as individual rights?
Because the judges could decide that a very bad judgment against them could affect all the Mohawks. You know, the judgment could say that the Mohawks do not have the collective right to transport cigarettes over the border. And that would be, disastrous, if a judgment said that. And particularly since the collective didn't make the argument. So if an individual makes that argument and loses, we all lose.
If they think they found me guilty, well, you know what? The whole nation's going to suffer from this. I shouldn't be fighting this. It's the whole nation. It's the whole community of everywhere, every community in Canada and the United States, basically. It's their fight. It's not mine, but I'm the only one that is bringing it to Supreme Court and fighting this.
It was plain to see that Derek was not going to drop his case. He was going to fight it all the way to the end, come hell or high water. The Council of Chiefs had no choice but to take things further. They were going to do something that they'd never done before. They demanded that the court allow them to intervene in the case against Derek. The judge agreed. Coming up next time on Running Smoke.
I have to say the Nation Council's involvement in the case right from the start was damage control. It was how do we minimize the potential damage that this court could do. Not our court, not our judge, not our law.
Running Smoke is a production of Campside Media, Dan Patrick Productions, and Workhouse Media. The series was written and reported by me, Rajiv Golwa. Our producers are Aaliyah Papes, Lane Gerbig, and Julie Deniche. Our editors are Michelle Lanz and Emily Martinez. Sound design and original music by Mark McAdam. Additional sound and mixing by Ewan Lai Tremuin. Additional reporting by Susie McCarthy. Our executive producers are Dan Patrick, Josh Dean of Campside Media, Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood for Workhouse Media. Fact-checking by Mary Mathis and Angeli Mercado. Artwork by Polly Adams, and additional thanks to Greg Horn, Johnny Kaufman, Sierra Franco, Elizabeth Van Brocklin, and Sean Flynn.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.